Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
And I said, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better. You can understand that, can't you?
Yes.
Good lad.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
The Welsh rugby team limped into this year's Six Nations with no form, no confidence and no victories last year over any team that wasn't Italy or Georgia. Now, helped by a series of red cards to opposition players and brain freezes by officials, they stand just two games, effectively one game, from winning a Grand Slam. And before you even suggest that this unbelievable streak of good fortune has to run out at some stage, I ask you this. Have you seen what's been going on in the France setup this week? Welcome to Monday Six Nations Second Captains Podcast. Hi, Murph.
Hey, Owen, how's it going?
It's going pretty well. Ken, how are you?
Very well, Owen, how are you?
Pretty good. Now, a quick recap on this run of good fortune so far. Opening game, Peter Mahoney for Ireland sent off in the 14th minute. Wales eventually managed to overcome 14-man Ireland for a 5-point win. Second game was against Scotland, who opened up a 14-point lead before imploding in part through a red card of their own. Wales win by one. And on Saturday, Wales scored two controversial first half tries, one with the aid of what looked like a knock-on, the other one, the first one, from a penalty that was taken while Owen Farrell was lecturing his teammates about their discipline under the post, as per the referee's instructions. So that's where we are up to now. As for the upcoming game against France, well, they've already caught their lucky break weeks in advance of that one, because France head coach Fabien Galthé is in the middle of a shitstorm of his own creation. French rugby chief Bernard Laporte confirmed last night that national coach Fabien Galthé had left the Six Nations secure bubble to watch his son play a game. Laporte told a French television station that on the day after France had beaten Italy 50-10 earlier this month, Galthié had left the biosecure bubble. He went to the Stade Jean Bouin in Paris to watch his 19-year-old son Mathis play a match. Previously, Fabien Galthié had hit back at claims that he'd breached the Six Nations health bubble in the week leading up to the COVID-19 outbreak in camp that forced the cancellation of Scotland's trip to Paris. At that point, he'd said, "All my actions comply with the health protocols. I do not understand these unwarranted accusations." Now, Laporte says Galthié's job is not in danger. And look, there's no guarantee this is going to knock France at all. The game is a good bit away, but it punctures this image of everything going seamlessly for them this year and heading into the World Cup in France 2023. And it just strikes me as another little notch possibly in favour of Wales. I don't know what you guys made of their the bit of fortune. Ken, not totally dissimilar situation in the football to what I described there between England and Wales in terms of Lewis Dunk for Brighton, having some communications with the referee. In his case, I think he also asked, you know, "Let me know, can I take this? Can I take this quick? And the ref goes, "Yeah, no bother." But in that case, the referee then changed his mind and whistled for the play to end before the ball went in, thereby saving the blushes of the opponent's defense.
Yeah, well, the difference was that the Dunk's goal wasn't allowed to stand ultimately, although the referee tried to let it stand. And Because it was totally his fault that it wasn't a goal. You know, he blew his whistle and then just mystifyingly blew his whistle a second time as the ball was in flight, meaning, okay, the play's now stopped and the ball went in. And it was like, "Well, why did you do that?" It's like, "Well, I don't really know. I don't know why I did that. Maybe I didn't do that. Maybe it is a goal. and he signals that that it's a goal. And then the VAR are like, you blew the whistle the second time there. That means it can't count. And so he eventually had to accept that he'd done this. It was amazing. But like, it is funny how total the element of surprise can be in a football game.
Mm.
Like, I remember being at the... and those types of goal, to be honest, are always really annoying. Like, if you saw the Brighton, saw the reaction to... Like, Lewis Dunk obviously did this kind of rant is maybe too much, but, you know, angry interview after the game. Oh, why is the referee not here? You know, why is... We have not seen him. Where is he? Mm-hmm. I'm fronting up. And where is there... Why does the referee not have to front up? You know, and all this. If you actually look at what happened, though, none of the Brighton players celebrate. You know what I mean? Because they're kind of surprised by it as well. They kind of... They're like, well... And so Brighton are completely chancing their arm, you know, with the goal. Like, I remember seeing one of them. I was at Villa Park in 2004 to see Thierry Henry score one of these goals. It was a match chiefly memorable for the presence in the Villa Park press box or director's box of Kevin Costner, who was not an Aston Villa fan, but an Arsenal fan who had flown up for the day to see his beloved Gunners, mm-hmm. who then in their invincible season, led by the great Thierry Henry, who scored one of these goals where you take a free kick quickly and suddenly it's in the net before anyone's even had time to look up and see what's happening, which is what makes it so annoying. It's a goal that most of the people in the stadium have missed. Never mind the, you know, and you just see Thierry Henry kind of, this is my memory of it, is just seeing Thierry Henry sort of run off celebrating casually and going, what just happened? And the Villa players sort of looking around, sort of, whose fault is this? None of us are even watching. It is funny. I mean, these England players sound like they might have been caught in a similar type of...
Yeah, well, the message appears to be, anyway, that sure, you can take this free kick, but quick free kick, but should you? Really? You know, it's kind of against the spirit of, you know, what we've all come here to...
Well, it's not so much against the spirit. Like, it's okay, but it is... It is annoying.
Like, but Ken, the rugby holds itself to a higher standard.
Well, what I don't understand
this
is
sort
how...
of backdoor shenanigans from Wales is... I mean, as a great rugby commentator once said, I mean, if this is your game, you know, if this is your poison chalice, you could have it.
Yeah.
As Ken Burley once told the Welsh, in fact. once again, the Welsh are displaying a flair for this sort of underhand... and quite frankly, you know, not quite cricket kind of attitude towards the game of rugby.
But what surprised me a bit about the account that you've provided of this try is mm-hmm. the referee himself was part of the subterfuge.
Oh yeah. Well, he suckered England properly there.
So I mean, does he not have to kind of say, well, hang on a second, you know?
Well, he has. He has fronted up today. By fronted up, he has had a conversation with the manager of World Rugby's referees, who has relayed that conversation to Midi Olympique. I can only assume...
Helpfully.
I can only assume that Pascal Gauzère, the referee, said, yeah, that's okay. Joel Juche, I can never pronounce that surname, Murph, but then I can't pronounce many surnames. So Joel Juche, I'm going to go for, says, I believe...
I think it's just Judge, but with a little bit of a... You know, a sort of a French accent at the start there.
So he says, I believe one has to be transparent and not let things drag on and say what one thinks. There were two unfortunate events during the match, which were tough cases to handle. Pascal Gauzère recognised as such when he spoke to me on the phone. So, well, yeah, Pascal Gauzère has apparently admitted his mistakes there. So we'll get into all of that stuff in a little while with Shane and Jerry Thorney today. But Murph, we're in danger here. And I think both myself and yourself, Ken Birdie here, in fairness, has laid off the Welsh. But we are in danger at the moment of adding the Welsh to the list of haters out there. You know, we've already got the Scots on our back thanks to...
It's the Scotland rugby team.
...diatribes of the course greatest of this championship. So in fairness to Wales, we should mention the fact they were pegged back by England, who got it 24 all.
Oh. Ken, our own, absolutely. Like, and I have to say that I've heard quite a bit of belly aching from English people. I mean, not a massive, not from the players and management, I think, too much. But, you know, there has kind of been this, like, this idea that this game was stolen. I mean, England were, as you were are just about to say, I think, I mean, they did get it to 24 all. Like, at that stage, they absolutely had a meltdown. Like, it was terrible. Like, England's last quarter was just embarrassing from their point of view. And, you know, this is one game that they had plenty of opportunities to win, and Wales went and won it. So, no, like, more power to the Welsh.
That's all I can say.
Well, let's listen to how they did it. This is as described on BBC Radio Wales.
I let the time to give you a message for your teams.
I wouldn't give that, to be honest. That's an incredible decision, to be honest with you, because...
Wow.
No, I don't think that was a trade.
I listen to you.
Farrell's furious.
Sheedy to try to put Wales into lead. They like it. It's a good 35 metres plus the angle. That looks good. It is good. It's a demanding shot at goal for Callum Sheedy after 74 minutes. But he's got the length and he's got the accuracy. Gareth Davis puts it over the touchline. 40 points to 24. It is a resounding win. It is a triple crown for Wales. England beaten and dejected.
Yeah, just had to get that in there before our Welsh listeners start rounding on us like the Scots have been doing to poor Murph. Speaking of which, despite not playing this weekend, my little running order, such as it is, Murph, tells me there's a hog watch later on. So I look forward to seeing the fashion.
Why would I change? I mean, we draw up these running orders a full week in advance. I mean, I'm not going to be the one to call you on and say, oh, you know, we got to throw our plans out just because, you know, a poxy game didn't happen. Stuart Hogg is still out there. He's still being Stuart Hogg. Still, you know, Stuart Hogg's going to Stuart Hogg. Regardless of whether there's a rugby game or not at the end of the week.
That's to come later on. A short football podcast is already out today, which is available to everybody, featuring some Keane versus Redknapp chat and a little bit more. For tomorrow's full football podcast, you'll have to get signed up to the World Service on secondcaptains.com. Now let's get stuck further into this Six Nations.
Back to Campbell, back to Duggan, McLaughlin going for that line, and Ireland are in and over.
Simon, it's going to happen, isn't it? Wales are going to win this Grand Slam. Come on, admit it.
Every time we tried to analyse them over the last, not just this year, the last 15 years, we get it wrong because Wales are Wales and they just, different laws seem to apply to them in the Six Nations. But, you know, the idea of them being lucky, and they have been lucky for three games in a row, whatever way you shake it. But the two tries both came from some really quick thinking, you know, sort of quick-witted play, trying something a little bit cheeky. And also, they're already in brilliant attacking positions. And particularly for the crossfield kick for Josh Adams, they probably would have got another chance there. Who knows what they could have scored a try anyway. So the other thing is the way they responded to 24-all. Just amazing. I thought it was the best passage of play from any team in the Six Nations so far, and just plays in that whole Welsh mental strength thing. And if you even think of the World Cup, like they really probably should have lost to France, looked like they were going to lose to France, and then that red card as well. So this is going on a long time. And I find with the O'Mahony and Ferguson red cards, the analysis afterwards is, oh, both those teams would have won if it wasn't for the red cards. But like, red cards are just a mistake like any other, except a way bigger mistake. And they often come about, maybe not with the O'Mahony one, but they come about through pressure, or that you keep challenging the other team's breakdown. So the player feels like he has to throw himself at it more than he would have done. So it's an error, sometimes an unforced error, but a red card is just a mistake. Tough luck. And the way Ireland certainly imploded at the end of that game, you would have think they would have found a way to lose that no matter what. So it is a run of luck, but also Wales just stick in there.
I know one thing they do have to work on, Murph. I don't know if you noticed Rhys Samson in particular, his you know, the face you're supposed to put on after you've been awarded a dubious try.
Yeah.
He really has to work on that one. I mean, that guy, I know he's young, he's there's some rough edges and so on, and we love the way he plays with an honesty and a joy and someone say a naivety, but you just gotta at least pretend, make it look like you think the try is going to be given.
Owen, he plays for Wales in 2021. He knows no matter what facial expression he makes, they're going to get the call anyway. So why go through the rigmarole?
He could literally be saying no, you know, the arm to the neck. No, please, ref, no try.
I clearly knocked it on. No. I'm afraid we have to go upstairs to the Timo, who will rule in Wales' favour.
Well, for a weekend that had Ireland playing Italy and another match called off, we have actually ended up with quite a lot to talk about today. Shane, how are you?
Yeah, very good.
Good. And Gerry Thornley's been looking closely at this increasingly volatile situation around the French team. Gerry, how are things?
Not too bad, thanks.
So before we get into all that, Shane, I must say, the thought occurred to be watching you on... Firstly, I'm very impressed with the setup you have on Virgin. I think it works really well. Even more impressed with your newborn daughter staying silent for the entire broadcast, because you had a baby girl just last week. Incredible stuff.
Yeah, no, it's been nice. But it's sort of nice to dip out of it for a little while as well. So I'm very thankful for my wife for allowing me to do it. But yeah, there was, I don't know how she kept to both Joni, who's a new baby, and Neela, quiet. But well done, Emma.
Yeah, no, are you sort of living in slight nervous fear of, you know, that scene of the report or whatever it was, having to, the entire family coming in and having to sort of push them back while live on television?
Yeah, I do feel as if I've almost got one arm always pushed back, ready to hit the door if necessary. But I'm still in that, you know, that new parent, half awake, half sleep type thing. So I was just happy that I was awake the entire every time they came to me. I slumped over the keyboard, drooling on it.
Nicely done. But listen, congratulations to yourself and to Emma as well. Jerry, can I ask you what the latest situation here is with what's going on in France? Because, it appears on a simple reading of this, Bernard Laporte, the French rugby president, has confirmed the speculation that was going on for days that Fabien Galthié, the head coach of all people, was one of the people who breached their COVID bubble. But Laporte seems to have offered his support. Galthié's job is not under any threat at the moment. Is that the latest?
Yeah, that pretty much is. There had been reports that Galthié had left the camp, and it's been confirmed that he went to watch his son play for Colomiers Espoirs against Stade Francais Espoirs, but that he wore a mask. And therefore, as far as the French Federation are concerned, this is not breaking their biosecure bubble. Obviously, we would think differently in Ireland, because the biosecure bubble applying to the Irish camp is much more rigidly applied. So the Minister for Sport, who has a touchy relationship with Laporte going back years, has also asked for an inquiry. Roxana Marasinanu, she's asked them to have an internal French Federation inquiry, the results of which should be known in the next day or two. You're right. I think that's the key factor here, that the Minister for Sport has asked for an internal rather than independent inquiry, because there is absolutely no appetite whatsoever to have Galthié removed from his position as head coach of the French team, given he's done such a spectacular job. And they want him in situ for this entire World Cup cycle, culminating, of course, in the World Cup in France in 2023. So that's the latest. It's also been confirmed that the French squad, or some members of the French squad, while in Rome for the Italian game in round one, also left their hotel to go and eat waffles, of all things, in Rome. Jeepers, lads, at least have a pizza or some pasta, but like waffles, it really does question French culinary tastes. Maybe they must be declining. And that's been confirmed as well. But again, this is not supposedly breaking the biosecure bubble, because A, they wore masks, and B, they were tested when they came back. All of this is in the backdrop to Sir Simon, who's vice president of the French Federation. He's effectively their COVID manager. And there now have been, it's 12 positive cases, and 5 or 6 members of the staff, including 3 of the coaches, including Galthié, have all contracted COVID. There's also been a cluster in the French under-20s camp last January in their training camp in August. There's also been a cluster of cases in the Sevens, who have been brought in to train with the national squad in the Marcoussi bubble. And there's also been a cluster in the an outbreak of COVID in the women's national team as well. And Sir Simon is providing over all of this. So Marasinanu has requested that she speak only now with Laporte. She doesn't want to speak with Sir Simon about this, which is quite a slap in the face for him. But all things, when it all come, all this dirty linen has been washed in public, I still don't think Galthié is going to lose his job for the reasons I already outlined. Even this, though, this reflects very badly in him, because after all, as the head coach, he should be the one setting the example for the rest of the squad. And then you've got Simon's position as well, presiding over all these clusters. It seems to, from the outset, from this far removed, that this has been a very shabbily, amateuristically organised COVID bubble.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot there, Jerry. Firstly, congratulations to those French players who managed to not, they managed to wear masks while eating waffles. I mean, that's a physical impossibility, I would have thought. But more seriously, it seems like Laporte, on the one hand, is saying, yes, he did leave the camp. He did go to watch his son playing a rugby match, even though he had said he didn't. He said he didn't break any regulations. But in that, Laporte is saying he didn't actually break the bubble simply because he was wearing a mask. That essentially, and he also says, why wouldn't I support him? It's not because I really like Fabien. He knows very well I don't give gifts to people. But he's very much, on the one hand, essentially confirming all the reports are true, while on the other hand, completely backing his man.
Yep, exactly. That's what it is. Like I said, there's no desire to have Galthié removed. They think he's doing a wonderful job. They want him to stay in situ until the World Cup. There is no alternative to Fabien Galthié, so he will almost certainly survive. This is a very kind of French story, but it's likely to have a very French conclusion as well. And the key, like I said earlier, is the fact that the Minister for Sport asked for an internal inquiry. So this will be organised by the French Federation, and it's liable to absolve Galtier and everybody else of all blame. And they will carry on regardless.
So you get a feeling that this is a kind of a yes, Prime Minister investigation that's going to inquiry that's going to go on. They know the conclusion of it already, which is yeah. Fabien Galtier is going to remain in situ as French coach because everybody wants him to remain in situ as French coach. So how do we get to that point? Now, the this biosecure bubble sounds like the least secure bio bubble that I've ever heard of. 12 people getting tested are failing COVID tests with whatever regulations are in place means that they aren't working. I suppose what's interesting here is what are the regulations that are in place, because certainly in a when there's a break or 2 week break between Six Nations games, there is a sort of a breach of the bubble. So people leave the hotels, so they go back to their family environments, I'm sure, and I don't know what regulations are in place with them, or is it just the normal ones, or can you go out and get some food, or can you go out and get a coffee, can you go outside your house, all these things. I'm not sure what they are in France. I don't know what they are in particular in relation to the French team, but whatever they are, and if they have been breached, that's one point, but I don't know if we'll find that out. Or
it has echoes of the Dominic Cummins saga, doesn't it, about this? It's like
Barnard Castle written all over it here. So I do think, if there are, regulations that allowed both players to go out during, before the game in Rome and have a waffle in a cafe. Obviously that cafe was open, which is, I suppose is something that's different than in Ireland and the UK at the moment. And allowed Galtier to attend his son's match, again with a mask on. It's something that's different than what's going on in Ireland and the UK at the moment. So how are the regulations that apply in Italy or in France? Oh, sorry, France only. How are they, how are they being invested into the French national team? And it seems, and it's very clear, that whatever those regulations are, if they haven't been breached, they're not working.
The fact that this was on a knife edge, whether France will be allowed to compete in the Six Nations anyway, the fact that we already had the Josh Adams case, so they were forewarned, the fact that they sort of were denying this and now it's actually come out that they did break the bubble, and the fact that I think, well, you're jeopardising the whole tournament, you're jeopardising players' health, all those things come into it. I just wonder, Shane, if this happens, say Andy Farrell did this, and there was a hint of a cover-up, or Pivac or any of the other Six Nations coaches, I kind of feel they'd probably get sacked.
I kind of get that feeling myself as well. If you look at the position of the other coaches in the Six Nations as well, they're certainly not as secure as Galtier. And it could be a useful construct for any of those unions. But I agree with you. I think I don't know what the public perception is in France at the moment, or what the level of outrage is. I would imagine if that happened in Ireland or UK, it would be, people would be going crazy about it and would be, looking for heads, and it would be a political football that would be kicked around as well. And so I don't know what level this is going to go to. Listen, the other thing about this is there's a genuine gripe and concern from Scotland over this, saying, you haven't, or either you've breached your regulations of your bubble, or your bubble wasn't fit for purpose, and because of that it's cost us a game of the Six Nations, to this point potentially being rearranged. Then you've got all the club teams are saying again there's a huge financial impact of this. So if this game is going to be rearranged post the Six Nations window, all the clubs are going to have to acquiesce and let their players go and lose them for another week and potentially subject them to injury and all this type of things that that the clubs don't want to do in order to get this game played. So I can understand it. Yes, it is a matter internally for, you know, the French Union and, I don't know, maybe even the French government. But it does have a broader impact on the Six Nations. Now, I'm not saying kick France out the six out of this year's tournament, or don't allow them to play the Scottish game, because I think we need this Six Nations to run its course, and I want to see the conclusion.
Yeah, Stuart Barnes was saying that on Twitter. He thinks the bigger picture is actually a rugby tournament gets finished on the field. Yeah, yes, the French made a mistake.
And selfishly, I don't want to be punished. I don't want the tournament to be punished for, you know, individuals within the French Union and their setup. And I want to see this Six Nations run out. So, but I do think there should be consequences for it. There are consequences, either need to be as a result of a breach in that protocol or those regulations, or establishing regulations that don't appear to be fit for purpose. And I'm not saying it's easy to create a no COVID environment, even within these, you know, biosecure bubbles. But it does seem that, you know, Jerry, you know, pointed out all the different areas where the French where French rugby has fallen down, and it's a bit too convenient just to say, no one else has been affected by this in the same way throughout the Six Nations. No other team or no other federation has been affected by this in the same way. So you got to examine what France were doing either within the regulations or out the regulations. And then I do think there has to be a price to be paid for it. And as I said, one that jeopardizes this tournament, but there has to be something.
Jerry, can I ask you, what do you think the Scottish players would feel like, or the other teams that are due to play France, knowing how loose they've been in their sevens, in their women's, in this national team, all over the place, and we're going to play these guys and we're going to trust them again that they haven't had another breach or another positive test that they don't yet know about?
Oh, I would imagine they would have deep suspicions about the French and how lax and how amateur their whole biosecure bubbles have been set up, and the way they've been applied and what exactly they mean compared to everybody else, and how they've jeopardised the whole tournament here. There would be deep suspicions about them, and they've performed appallingly, really. Like, it's been... I spoke to one French journalist last week, Richard Esco from L'Equipe, and he's been there a long time, very highly respected rugby writer, and he said that there's a general feeling that they are sad and ashamed that the cloud of suspicion now hangs over the French COVID protocols, which have forced the postponement of one match and to some degree even jeopardised the tournament. So, yeah, they have behaved appallingly. But of course, pretty much in kind of typical kind of like akin to the Dominic Cummins saga as well, like there's never a hint of an apology for all this, because once you start apologising, then you leave yourself open to all sorts of consequences. I think the French Minister for Sport were quite like an apology of some kind. She's intimated as much. Then she said we can reboot from a good place because the competition is not over yet. I think therein lies the clue that they've no intention of kicking the French out of the tournament. There has been talk of when the Scottish match is going to be rescheduled. It definitely won't be this Saturday, but there has been talk of tomorrow week, Tuesday the 9th, as being a possibility. I'd be surprised if that came to pass. But yes, it's denied. It's also, as well as cancelling that game last Sunday, it's potentially now denied the Six Nations of a grand finale, a Super Saturday, once again, for the second year in a row, primarily because the French haven't managed their protocols as well as they should have done.
That just reminded me of a Sopranos episode where Tony is talking to Ralph and telling him not to apologise for what he said. He said, do not apologise for making that comment, because you get into apology and then, what do you have to apologise for? Yeah. So I think we'd be holding our breath on that one.
Well, what's interesting about this,
what's
interesting about this, I think, as well, is it's taken a bit of the gloss off what France have been doing on the pitch. And, you know, there's been nothing but good headlines around them for the last year or so. And there was almost an assumption they're going to win the Grand Slam and they're going to go on and have a great World Cup on home soil. That seems to... I mean, that might still happen. They might be able to shrug this off in terms of getting back on the field. But I can't help think it somewhat plays into Wales' hands, Shane, after, their run of fortune that started in the first game and has continued right through this tournament. I see today that Pascal Gauzère has recognised his errors, according to World Rugby's head of match officials, Joel Juch. He says that Gauzère has recognised his errors, having reviewed the two incidents in the Wales versus England game. I mean, a bit late now, but I suppose it's better recognising them than not.
Yeah, I think that's useful that he's done that. It's not just him though. There was, you know, he was certainly played a part in it, but his whole TMO team as well concurred with what he said, which just amazed me. But I have noticed there does tend to be a bit of groupthink on these decisions.
That's what Joel Jooch said, yeah, as part of that same thing. He said that there is a trend of listening too much to your TMOs and that he got into that. But I mean, I don't know, that maybe there needs to be clearer guidance for referees then, or
it was so easy for the TMO. It was so easy for the TMO to get that decision right.
Yeah.
I mean, there's one thing relying on.
Sorry, you're talking about the knock-on as opposed to...
Well, the knock-on in particular, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's something around not wanting to contradict each other or to be seen because it is all being broadcast to, the TV audience. It takes quite a confident TMO to contradict a referee or even a referee the other way around, because they're thinking, well, listen, you're in the van, you're seeing the pictures. So it does mean it's almost who says what first, and then they kind of row in behind that. And I think that's what happened. I was really surprised that the first decision, I did feel it was just didn't... it was contrary to sort of natural justice. That's what it felt like. And it also, if there's not clarity on this, and I'm glad he's come out and he said it's an error, because if they don't make it clear, then don't ever ask a captain to go back and have a word with his team. Don't ever do that, because they never will again. And why would they? Because you say, I'll go back and do what you've asked me to do. I'll bring them in. And then meantime, you've got the opposition winger hanging, waiting for a kick. And, you don't give us any time to get back into position. So, you know, why would I possibly do that? So it's kind of, you know, that is one of those sort of traits of rugby that I don't know if it's strictly written down, any of that strictly written down in the laws, but certainly we need clarity on it now. Otherwise, nobody's going to be speaking to their pack ever again or their team.
I thought the first try was even worse in some respects, because the referee actually handicapped England by his own approach. And I think, in fairness to Farrell, he tried communicating with them. And if you look back at it, Gozer is just not listening to him. He's just giving him, look, too many penalties, sorted out. And then he handicaps England by blowing his whistle. If you look from behind the goal, freeze frame, there are five water carriers still on the pitch when Dan Biggar cross kicks to Josh Adam. Five, three in the Welsh side, two in the English side. It was just a ridiculous, nonsensical decision. And you're right about it takes a strong TMO or even a linesman, a refereeing assistant, to disagree with the referee on his initial interpretation of event. A classic instance being the late hit by Owen Farrell and Stephen Varney for the Anthony Watson intercept try. Because Mike Adamson went that way initially, Romain Poit agreed with him and Joy Neville did not disagree with them. But clearly it was a late hit. When he said it was chest to chest, he was wrong, because it was chest to back. And the point being, whether it would be dangerous or not, it was off the ball and late, and therefore the try should have been disallowed. But because Mike Addison said chest to chest and no violent play, they all went along with it. And you're right, Shane, it takes a strong strong refereeing assistant or TMO to then overrule, if you like, a referee.
Shane, have you ever seen a team go on a run of three games where luck or some major, major incident gets them into a game, certainly? Like, Wales still had to go and win those three games, I suppose. But I don't think I've ever in any sport seen three games in a row like this.
Yeah, well I think we should say remove luck a little bit, because we all play, every team plays within the laws of the game. And both Ireland and Scotland breached those laws, and they were penalised correctly on both. There's no doubt about either of them. And if you fail to do that, there's not then, you know, luck for Wales and taking advantage of that. It's, you know, poor play from the opposition and then good play from Wales for making sure that they won both those games. Now, you know, the craziness of the sequence is what I've never seen, and I don't know if we will ever see that again. And having being so important to the results as well, because I do feel as if, you know, it was looking as if, and who knows, but it was looking that Ireland was in good shape against Wales, especially the run of form that Wales were in up to that. The Scottish performance, I'm not sure if that was the defining. Well, it was the defining moment, but whether it meant 100% that Wales were only won the game as a result of that sending off, I'm not sure. And then we really don't know what the impact of these two crazy refereeing decisions were on the result. But, and I think it's too simplistic to look at directly correlation between on the scoreboard. And I actually did notice that both of those tries were advantages to very kickable penalties as well. So, you know, Wales were in the position to take scores, not five pointers, but they were certainly in the position to take scores when those bad refereeing decisions were made. And, you know, England certainly had every opportunity and did get back into that game and looked for all the world to be in the box seat to win it. And couldn't. And Wales, fought, courageously and with some, excellent play as well to win that game. But the fact that there was this, sequence of games with these, peculiar occurrences in each is quite outlandish. And it's been good for Wales. It's fantastic. And what's interesting now is, where does this story end? What's the conclusion to this? And we don't know, but I'll be watching the next two games very interested.
Jerry, I have to say, from 24 all onwards, I thought Wales put in the best period of play that any team has put in the Six Nations so far. And this just seems to go back years and years. I used to think it was down to maybe Gatland and Edwards, but then you think Mike Ruddock sort of had a bit of that quality in that Welsh team, and now we have Pivac doing the same. So there might just be something in the Welsh rugby culture that makes them stick in games better than other teams. As you said, Shane, on Virgin Media, they never get beaten. You have to beat them. Even when they're playing crap, even when they're down a load of players, something, there's just a doughty spirit about them. But I just wonder now, Jerry, like, they surely can't get this sort of look again. They'll beat Italy, but assuming they play France and everything goes ahead as normal, they still feel like a far inferior side to France. But then maybe we just give up on analysing and predicting games at this stage.
Well, they've always had that, you're right, and they still have it. Like, they're never, ever beaten until the fat lady sings. They have an amazing capacity like no other team over the last 10, 15 years in the Six Nations of pulling off outrageous comebacks when they look dead and buried. And that has been their... They've had that characteristic more so than any other team in the Six Nations going back quite a while. They're remarkably resilient when they pull on those red jerseys together. And as we discussed ad nauseum, their form for the Dragons and the Ospreys and the Cardiff Blues and the Scarlets just seems to be irrelevant. You and I have spoken about this, you and me, Simon, about maybe they almost benefit from not having that many high-pressure games for their provinces in Europe or elsewhere or in playoffs for the Pro 14, because they very rarely feature in them. And so they elevate their game when they play for Wales. But yeah, from 24 all, I'd say if you'd rang any bookies then, England were hot favourites to go and complete the win.
Yeah.
And they win the last quarter 16-0. And they were very disciplined. They were very focused. They didn't just kick their way then to victory with three penalties. They went down the pitch, albeit off an intercept, and then scored a well-worked try to actually claim a bonus point win. And now they're going to go to Rome and win there, no doubt about it. And so they're going for a Grand Slam the last game. It's quite extraordinary. It just shows you the old word in this tournament, momentum. You get a little bit of momentum at the beginning. You get a few breaks. You get a win or two under your belt. And everything that happened before is just that. It's just history. It doesn't seem to count anymore. And they will be cock-a-hoop now. And, you know, the joke in Wales going into the last Saturday's game was there were only three red cards away from a Grand Slam. Well, now there are only two.
Well, we were talking about them last week, Shane, and I don't know, was it Andrew Trimble? Was it, between the lot of us, we end up concocting some phrase along the lines of them having what seemed like fake confidence at the start of this tournament, but at some point, fake confidence can become real confidence. You know, the whole fake it till you make it thing. And of course, they absolutely have that now. So it's almost irrelevant analysing how they played in the first 20 minutes against Ireland or whatever, because that's a different team now. It certainly looks that way to me anyway.
Literally, the back line is a different team.
And that's not an insignificant fact either, Simon. Their back line is much better than the opening back line of the Six Nations. They are, the momentum thing is certainly there. But I just can't put it down to, purely to momentum. Yes, Wales seem to be able to harness that better than any other team, but they put themselves in the best position to be able to to feast on any momentum that's there, and no other team does it as well. I know Ireland have got going before, and when you say England when they started off the Six Nations well, but I do think Wales capitalise on it more than any other team. And it is part of that, you know, teamship that comes from that comes with Wales that doesn't exist in their regions, never has and might never. But it's almost because it doesn't exist in the same way in their regions, there's an absolute thirst and desire and a focus that it does exist within Wales. And not only does it exist, they've used it to their advantage. You know, they use it to their advantage so often. And I'm thinking, how does that manifest? One, as I said the weekend, you said there, Simon, they never, ever beat themselves. That's what Wales don't do. They don't beat themselves. They don't, you don't see them doing silly things and go, oh, you know, they threw that game away. They never do that. They stay in the game. They make you beat them. And what happens with a team like that, even if you feel as if you're quite a bit better than them at the start of the game or going in, or if you get a couple of scores up, there comes a point at some stage in the game where you go, hang on a second, we're much better than this team. We've been more dominant. We got two scores up early. We got, we were throwing the ball around, but somehow they're less than two scores away from us. And that then, there's a pressure that comes on the team. You almost start focusing on the scores. How are they still in this? How are we not way ahead of them? And then that flips the pressure and you see the opposition starts to tighten up. And it's almost like Wales can sense that. And they never tighten up. They never tighten up. Actually, they loosen up as the game goes on. And that's the other thing. Like for the first 20 minutes of that game, I remember I wrote down in my notes, I was going, this is a good game if you like to see big players running into each other, because that's what it was. It was so many one-out runners, so, you know, really physical bash. It felt like a rugby league game and the worst aspects of rugby league. I was like, this is no good. And then it really got going. England got going. And then Wales got going. And instead of, you know, what you would think would happen is they were tightened up and panic as a result of it coming, getting back to a drawn match early in the second half. It's then they are able to almost throw the shackles off a bit. And they're very confident in their skill level. And a lot of it doesn't add up to me, you know. But what's clear is they do have a lot of good players in that back line, especially. If you look at that back line, it's very impressive.
Yeah.
It's very impressive. They're all confident when they're playing for Wales. So they will take the opportunities that come from them. They're relatively comfortable, not as comfortable in the defence as they were, but as the game went on, the defence got better. And then they're all capable. And you look at, you know, Adams, you look at Williams, they want to throw the ball around. Zammit, they will throw the ball around and trust themselves, and that they will do that in the last minute if necessary.
And look at briefly at how their new caps cope. And a lot of these aren't with the provinces, like Rhys Zammit. Look at Hardy taking a quick tap and scoring a try. He's never played Champions Cup before. You know, it isn't anything, I don't think, to do with the regions particularly. There's just that confidence that comes through it. And you know, we make big arguments for why we don't try players who don't have enough experience. They put them in and those guys just seem to adapt.
Yeah, and really well. Hardy was really good, really good. And the 10 that came on, actually, what was his name?
Sheedy. Oh, Sheedy playing for Bristol. He's another guy.
He was brilliant.
He's only has a few caps.
He was incredible when he came on.
That was a really ballsy call by Wayne Pivac, bringing on Callum Sheedy. Was it the 45th minute or something? He's not known for his goal kicking and he just nervously takes all those three. And he adds another attacking dimension as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, but I think when it says something about a camp, and it's really important. The best teams that I ever played with were when there was a real confidence in the backup. So not just even the 23, but actually a little bit deeper in the squad. And you know, the least successful ones were where we thought we've got 15 men on the pitch here, and those 15 men are all fit and all playing. Then we can beat anyone. But you take one person out of that, and there's either a drop off or a perceived drop off or not a trust within the squad. And you can see that, you know, those Welsh players and the coaches and the way that they behave, they trust the squad depth and they give opportunity to those players. And I suppose it's not just a case of giving opportunity, it's when you need them. And he was needed at that point. You know, Hardy was that's a big call to pick Hardy in that game as well. Mm. They were needed. They've been asked to step up. They stepped up and they delivered. And now there's that ongoing trust that will be there for the foreseeable future, where you've got where you know you've got squad depth, and when if someone goes down or we have to make changes or they want to freshen things up, you've got a squad, you've got players in the squad to move into key positions and to do it very comfortably.
All right, England, we'll probably talk about them more next week ahead of their game against France. Obviously the rest week, but I mean, pretty poor stuff from then. What about Ireland?
It was, yes, there was some really poor stuff, some really silly stuff from England and un-England-like stuff. And I think there are, you know, some issues that are kind of deep in that squad that Eddie Jones has to get to grips with. And I think they can certainly do with freshening things up. And I think he probably will. There's huge momentum at the moment in the UK and desire for you know, new faces into it. But they played some phenomenal rugby. And if you look at that Ben Young's try, it was as good a try as you'll see. And we'll come on to Ireland. And the reason I wanted to bring it up, Owen, was because, you know, we're talking about shape and getting the shape right. Now, Ireland, you could see sort of Ireland shape, but you could really see England shape when they got it right. And it was, you know, if you get a chance to sort of review that Ben Young's try, it was absolutely excellent. There was three waves. It was the first, ball carrier who put it out the back. And then there was another wave of a really good screen that was, you know, they were both a threat, and there was the depth of the third wave coming around was perfect as well. The ball went out to them, passed really nicely, got to the edge, so got on the outside of the Welsh defensive line, which is exactly what you want to do. That's what you're aiming for. May takes a great line, fights really hard to stay in touch, exactly what he needed to do. Good ball presentation. Then the next, there was fast ball from that ruck to a pod of, I'd say there was four people streaming down that zone. So it was very hard to defend. You've got bodies everywhere. It's over the gain line again. So there's momentum there. And everybody's ready for the system play, which is from 9 to 10. And then you have the second wave coming around again, or you hit that pod up. So everybody's waiting for that. They're panicking for it. And what does Ben Youngs do? He goes, actually, we've got, you know, this is our system, but I can break away from the system because I've read what one of their defenders has done. They've panicked on how good this system has been implemented. They've panicked, pushed out, and the option for me is to go through the middle and score a try. It's absolutely textbook. There you have your system executed brilliantly, individual skills perfect, but then someone reacting with that system to make a decision to score a try. So that's why I think Eddie Jones is a brilliant coach, and that's why I think the capacity for England still remains incredibly high. And it's also why I think we have a long way to go to get anywhere close to that for Ireland.
Well, what about that, Jerry? Did you see anything from Ireland at the weekend in a comfortable win that leads you to believe that we are getting something right in our attacking shape?
Could I just say very quickly about England that they gave away 14 penalties and nearly every one of them was justified, and that was as much a cause of their downfall as the two awful decisions for the first two Welsh tries. And I do think when historians look back in this period in rugby history, the ripple effects of the Saracens imbroglio will be seen for everything that it is, because the five players, key players in that team, who played one game since December going to the Six Nations, and they're just not match sharp. And it's partly, along with their kind of loose approach, the way they play the game with regard to the laws, it's partly why they do concede so many penalties. That being said, the daftest of them all was by Dan Robson, was changing his line in front of a chaser. But worryingly, I think England will be at their best come round five, probably, than certainly they were in round one, because so many of these players now are going to get four test matches under their belts. Ireland, I thought Ireland were good. You know, I really thought they were good. I loved the start, because I thought the start of the game was the most valid part of the game, because the Italians were still up for it. They hadn't been beaten off the pitch by that stage. Yes, Ireland lost their way in the second half a little bit. I thought there was, for me, the most striking things were the way players were coming hard onto the ball. They weren't taking it statically. There was very little of the kind of slightly lateral lines of running that we saw against France. For me, it was just another, yet another reminder, not that we really should need it. For all the talk about Johnny Sexton's age and his contract position, he's still the best Irish 10. He's still a world-class 10 when you get an 80 minutes like that out of him. But simply by dint of running straight, by bringing other players into the game, by calling the shots, the master puppeteer, he was heavily involved in four of the six drives, the three first-half ones, and the last one with his pass to Earls. He just facilitates other people around him. He creates space for other people around him. The way he tapped the blind side with Jemison Gibson-Park and released Larmour, and then swinging back left and hitting Gary Ringrose for the Hugo Keenan try, I just thought it just shows you how much more efficient and effective a team Johnny Sexton, Ireland are when Johnny Sexton is there. That was the big thing for me.
Yeah, I thought we were poor enough in the second half, really good in the first half. Loved the offloads, particularly the Keenan line from Ringrose. Ringrose was brilliant. And I think there was signs that Ringrose is starting to listen to what Andy Farrell was saying before the game about communication and taking more on himself. And the wingers hopefully communicate more as well. I think we need to look at both wingers. I don't even know anymore who our best wingers are, but we've had doubts about every winger that's come in, whether it's Conway or Stockdale or whoever. So I think there's issues there. We need to get more from our wingers when you look at Wales in particular. But then, Shane, I looked at our pack before the game and I wondered, hang on, has he actually hit on our best eight here to start for, you know, Scotland and England? What did you think? Particularly, I think Tadhg Byrne now has to play in an Irish team no matter what. Connors probably looks like our best seven. That's our best second rows. I think Kelleher maybe starts. The two props you could debate, I suppose. But what did you think of the eight overall?
I thought they were very good. And more than Johnny Sexton, and he did have a good game, right the way through that first half, and I kept on writing down gain line. Because that's what the basis of this performance was. We got over the gain line almost with every single carry. And that's not just because we could physically outmatch Italy, but we could. I thought there was definite progress in how we tried to get over the gain line. Even the fact that we went, with that first line, we went for the long throw over the top to Henshaw, gave us real momentum. But if you see the next couple of carries after that, we hit that at a million miles an hour. We're running onto the ball at, you know, full pace or not far off full pace. And that was, again, giving us a little bit more momentum to get over the line and get over the gain line. And when you do that, it means that your 10 can run onto the ball, attack it, because the defence isn't set fast enough. The big problem for us is that when we don't get over the gain line or we get stopped dead, then our first receiver, whether it be a forward as part of a pod to carry as a one-out runners or a drop-off either side, or the 10, ends up standing still and then moves on the pass as opposed to moving as they're getting the ball. And again, that brings them over the gain line or holds the inside defence. So, you know, and to be honest, and I know we've had tough times against Italy before, but generally our issue isn't getting over the gain line against Italy. And you know, that will remain an issue as we go on to the next two games. So I think, you know, is that a peculiar ability to get over the gain line against Italy and then it makes everything else look a little bit better? Or are we genuinely going to be in a better position to get over the gain line against anyone because of our timings, a little bit of ingenuity and our shape? So that's the kind of key interesting thing for me. But yeah, I think we have, you know, stumbled across a number of important points. Tadhg Furlong is very crucial to us, I think. I think the whole front row probably should be retained if fit. I thought they carried harder. They were a little bit more physical, a bit more explosive, and it made a difference. And Tadhg Furlong's, you know, passing is crucial if they do want to try and implement this second wave defence, and I think they are doing that. Again, the same with Tadhg Byrne. I think him at six, he looked very good. I kind of like him in the second row because I think you can get him to do the second row job and almost perform that six role as well. So you're kind of, I like players that can do a job on a half. But you know, the two second rows performed well. I think he would do well in that sixth position. Connors is really helpful for the other players in the way he tackles as well. He's very much a
his hands are good tackler as well. Connors has shown signs his hands are pretty good.
Yeah, and he seems confident, but he seems comfortable. at international level. He doesn't seem overawed in any way, and it seems as like, yeah, this is where I am. It's natural for me to be here, and because of that, I think he's one of the players that are potential to be less risk averse. And again, I mentioned Furlong. I think Furlong's confident, very confident of his own skill set. He's very confident in that environment. The more players you have in that, the better. And also Byrne, not because he's used to playing international rugby, but he's used to performing the skills that he's being asked to perform at this level. So he's only really doing more of the same. So again, it's difficult to judge against this Italy side because they are poor. You know, they are. We can't say they're not. But I did think there was definite green shoots, and we're in a much better position now than we were going into the Italian game, and we have a big opportunity to progress or just maintain. And if we do that, I'd be very impressed, because there was many elements of that performance that I really enjoyed.
All right, well, Shane, that's your break finished with. We'll let you get back to your parenting duties now. Thanks a million. Thanks, Jerry.
Thanks a million. Cheers,
man. Cheers, Raggy.
Ken Burley from News Talk Dublin. Welcome back, Ken.
How you doing? You know that Stephen Ferris is bone on bone in one of his knees. So what did Wales do? They picked him up and flung him to the ground bodily. It's no way to treat a man in his condition. I mean, we were treated our conditions. We know that we're going to be the same island. We're going to be standing up for what's good for the game. You know, the Welsh performance to me stood for brutality. It stood for cynicism, cold-eyed, remorseless killing. I mean, if that's the game that you guys want to play, I mean, I say you can have your poison cup.
It is a regular Monday tradition in this year's tournament, but your guess is as good as mine as to how Murph has cobbled this one together, seeing as Stuart Hogg wasn't playing at the weekend. It's Hogwatch.
You know, I had a huge amount of belief within the boys to come down here and win.
Stuart Hogg turns up to a winning the bloody World Cup. I love it!
Stuart Hogg!
I believed in the boys' ability.
Man of the match!
Scotland are a disgrace to work for.
No, it's Hogglebox. Remember?
You've
changed
yeah,
it to Hogglebox.
Hogglebox.
So
it's
Hogglebox time now, yeah. And you'd miss him, wouldn't you? I mean, I will say this though, even though Scotland weren't playing this weekend, you'd have to say that was an absolutely unbelievable Scotland tribute act that England put on Saturday evening. I mean, that level of hilarity was just the pickup we needed once we knew Scotland weren't going to be playing this weekend. Instead, Stuart had to spend an interminable weekend shacked up with 40 other people whose first name is also a surname. I'm sure both the Grants, the two Darcys, Scott, Finn, Duncan, and all the Adams enjoyed binging on Bridgerton and will be raring to go for their next game, which I will, of course, be watching very closely indeed, whether that's against France or against us. Hogwatch!
You know, I had a huge amount of belief within the boys to come down here and win.
Stuart Hogg turns up
to a
winning the bloody World Cup. I love it!
Stuart Hogg!
I believed in the boys' ability.
Man of the match!
Scotland are a disgrace to work for.
Beautifully done, Murph. That'll fill the void for me until we get to see the glorious side of Stuart Hogg doing his thing.
We don't know what's going to happen, but we know it'll be entertaining. I love this man.
Thanks, Murph. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Owen. Thank you, Ken.
Owen, and thank you, Ciarán.
Thanks for listening, and thank you especially to our members who are making this thing happen, and we'll talk to you guys again on the World Service tomorrow.
What phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.